This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. On the program today, we take up the topic of men's health. Listeners, I welcome your telephone calls this afternoon for Dr. Richard Corlin. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Dr. Corlin is a gastroenterologist, the president of the American Medical Association. He teaches at the UCLA School of Medicine. He is also a fellow of the American College of Physicians and a member of both the American Gastroenterology Association and the American Society of Internal Medicine. Early in his career, Dr. Corlin served in the U.S. Public Health Service, where he worked in the Heart Disease and Stroke Control Program. As president of the AMA, Dr. Corlin is associated with a new AMA book on health, the American Medical Association Complete Guide to Men's Health. The book is a guide to understanding the male body and maintaining health and fitness while preventing illness. It is also a reference useful for finding answers to questions about medical problems, their diagnosis, and treatment. The AMA Guide to Men's Health is published by John Wiley and Sons. Our telephone numbers again, 333-9455. That's the number to use in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Dr. Corlin, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
What led the AMA to put together a guide to men's health?
Really a companion to our guide to women's health that we've had for some period of time, and also our guides to family health. We came to realize that paying attention to men's health was in many cases the missing piece in the family health guides. Everybody is obviously and very appropriately concerned about regular health checkups for children and also routine care for women. Pap smears, mammograms, and so on. But we came to realize that in an era where there's more prostate cancer than breast cancer, men really follow along the pattern where, you know, we never ask directions. And we just wait till symptoms occur. And that's not the right thing to do. There's a lot of disease that can be avoided by paying attention to lifestyle, to early symptoms, to routine checkups. I dare say in most families, the children and the women get routine checkups and the men often don't.
Yeah.
And we think this is a situation that can be corrected. I think in many respects, this is a, you know, it's a, I'm glad this book is coming out this time of year because it's an excellent book for women to buy for the men in their lives. And I guess in a tongue-in-cheek way, we could really call it the owner's manual for a man.
Hmm. I suspect that men are often more reluctant to go to the doctor than women are, and that's another good reason for women to get a hold of this book, for the men that they love.
I think that's absolutely true. We wait for symptoms to develop, and even when that occurs, we just tend to prolong them too long and hope that they'll go away rather than deal with them at an early time when they can be dealt with much more easily, or even before that, preventively to be avoided.
Yeah. How often should men see a physician for a checkup?
Well, that depends upon a variety of circumstances. It depends, first of all, upon their age. Certainly, every man should have a complete checkup as a 40th birthday present. And this assumes, however, that they have been basically previously healthy before then. If men have either an individual history of some problems, whether it be high blood pressure, high cholesterol, heart trouble, diabetes, or any of the other myriad conditions that can occur, Obviously, we hope they'll be under continuing care before that age. But if we have a man who, first of all, is individually healthy, and secondly, doesn't have a family history of serious disease, and let's use a couple examples. Somebody who's in a family with a history of early heart attacks. Somebody who's in a family with a history of multiple colon polyps or colon cancers. These are things that need to be paid attention to. So I would think that men, as they mature out of their 20s and into their 30s, need to basically ask two questions. What is my medical history, and what is my family's history? And if they're both negative, then a visit to a physician for a comprehensive physical at the age of 40 is probably fine, although there should be some checking of those things beforehand that are easy to check: blood pressure, cholesterol, blood sugar, and so on, which can be routinely done in a simple little visit.
Mm. Now, when should men begin being tested for the antigen for prostate cancer?
Again, that depends on family history, but certainly by that's a good 50th birthday present for a man to get a baseline level, and then probably every 5 or so years thereafter. But because this prostate cancer is a condition which, number one, occurs typically late in life, but we're seeing it occur earlier and earlier. Most important thing is that when this condition is caught early, it is fully treatable and easily treatable without a lot of disruption in lifestyle. It's certainly not a condition we want to let go until it causes serious symptoms. We want to detect it before it causes any symptoms at all.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't mind these birthdays so much, but these presents are beginning
yeah.
to bother me. We've mentioned, or you've mentioned now a couple of times, family history, and not too long ago there was another doctor that appeared on this program, and he strongly suggested that we draw up a comprehensive family history and share that with the doctor. And his advice is mirrored in this guide. In fact, there's a questionnaire and a form for completing a family health history tree. When you see patients, how important is that family history, and do you work with them to complete a thorough family history?
It's very important. I'm a gastroenterologist, and I see a lot of patients. excuse me. I see a lot of patients who come in for evaluation of rectal bleeding or colonoscopy, a screening colonoscopy for polyps or cancer, and I even have people call on the phone and ask when should they be screened. There are clearly four different levels of risk for that, depending upon what the family history is. Is there a history of colon polyps or cancer at all? Is there more than three people in the family across two generations? Is there a history of what's called multiple polyposis, where you have huge numbers of people in the family who have multiple polyps in their colon? And if that occurs, you need to begin to start checking people in their early 20s. So from that standpoint, the family history will lead us to at one point should a colonoscopy be done. Similarly, if somebody has a history in their family of multiple cases of early coronary artery disease, then we want to start checking and evaluating people well before they begin to have any symptoms, quite possibly in their late 30s, particularly now that we have some non-invasive procedures to be able to get a look at the coronary arteries to see if there's any occlusion. Women, for instance, who come from families where there's a history of multiple cases of breast cancer need to be individually checked, and they probably need to have some genetic checking as well, since we know that there are some associations with that. So in every case, it's important to get a history of not just one case, because one case of any disease will occur, you know, across the board, but is there a pattern of a lot of people in the family getting certain diseases, the same disease, and particularly at an earlier age when it's expected. What we've learned about preventive medicine is that we want to get the people in the family who have not yet had symptoms and be able to get them checked. I can think of numerous families that have had people come in with no symptoms at all, in whom we have found early polyps, early cancers, got them taken care of, and they're living completely normal lives, whereas if things had gone on for two or three or four more years, they would have been in serious trouble.
Mm. When is a colonoscopy indicated, other than in cases where there's a real strong family history of colon cancer or colon polyps?
I think a colonoscopy is indicated for anyone who has rectal bleeding, clearly. And this is either if it is seen or if at the time of physical examination, and they get these little cards where you put a stool specimen on and mail it back, mm-hmm. and it's checked chemically for blood if they're positive. A colonoscopy under these circumstances is clearly indicated. And I think we need to put rectal bleeding under these circumstances in the same category as anybody with middle chest heaviness and pain, or any woman with a lump in their breast. And that every case of rectal bleeding isn't colon cancer. Every case of a person with heavy or crushing chest pain isn't a heart attack, and every woman with a lump in her breast doesn't have breast cancer, but they all are either colon cancer, heart attack, or breast cancer, depending upon which one we're talking about, until it's proven otherwise. And we now have, in all those three cases, and in many more cases, a circumstance to be able to prove in or out whether it's the serious condition we're worried about. And it would be just an awful, awful shame to not do this relatively simple testing to detect things early if they're there to detect, or rule them out and put people at ease. Again, in my type of practice, we see a fair number of people who come in with esophagitis, the symptoms of which are often associated with some spasm of the esophagus that can mimic exactly a heart attack. And many of these people have appeared first for heart workups, cardiac workups. And when that's ruled out, we get other things considered and dealt with. But I think the rule, first of all, has to be, is there something which is a potential life-threatening situation that can cause these symptoms? If so, let's rule it out, and once having ruled it out, we can then deal with the other less serious conditions that are going on.
Okay. We have a number of listeners waiting to talk with us now, so let's go first to our first caller this afternoon on line one in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi. Regarding colonoscopy, could you contrast versus sigmoid, how good is that in combination with barium imaging and that? And I wanted you to mention further, I understand there's a non-invasive imaging thing that's being used, but it's not something my HMO is probably going to be fond of, and I'm suspicious of them as far as really implementing the kind of preventative testing that they should be. And should I accept a sigmoid over a full colonoscopy?
Okay.
I have a family history. I'm also, well, I'll let you, I have another follow-up if I could.
Let me ask you one question first. Family history of what?
My mother had colon cancer, successful type 2 surgery and a little chemo afterwards, and my brother has had polyps removed. And,
okay, and how old are you?
I'm 50.
Okay. There are several ways you can get screening of the colon. And you basically have mentioned them all. One is a sigmoidoscopy, second a colonoscopy, third is a barium enema, and the fourth is the so-called non-invasive or virtual colonoscopy. Now, with the virtual colonoscopy is basically a scanning procedure. You go through the same prep as for a regular colonoscopy, and you can get an image of the entire inside of the colon. Let's go through all of them and see their strong and weak points. Sigmoidoscopy and colonoscopy are basically both the same kind of procedure, except that the sigmoidoscopy examines the lower third of the colon. The colonoscopy will examine the entire colon. It is my belief, and I think at this point the belief of most people, that for a screening procedure, checking for colon cancer, that there is not much of a role for a sigmoidoscopy. It is easier to do. It can be done in a conscious patient. It can be done in the physician's office. It's a 2 or 3 or 5 minute procedure with some discomfort, but it's moderate, and you have it done and go home. It's valuable in those cases where you're looking at known disease other than polyps or tumors very low down in the colon and need to follow it along. But for a screening procedure, for looking for the possibility of a polyp or a tumor in the colon, particularly in your circumstance where you have two members of your family across two generations who've had polyp disease and cancer in the colon, I would say that at the very least a colonoscopy is in order. Now, if you pair a sigmoidoscopy with a barium enema, you will examine the entire inside of your colon. The advantage of a colonoscopy is that if something is found, particularly a polyp, it can be removed right then and there. Polyps tend to be one of two shapes. They're either a little flat, raised area on the colon, or it can be shaped like a mushroom. And in one case, it can be biopsied and have most of it removed. In the other case, it can be taken off with a little, like a wire lasso that's put around it, and burn it off and get the whole thing out. And then we can tell if it's benign, if it's malignant, what kind of tissue it is at all. And in most cases, be done with it at that point. It's our belief now that most cancers of the colon arise from polyps that have been there for many, many years and then become malignant. Now, as far as the virtual colonoscopy is concerned, it is getting better with each passing year as the software to display the images improves. It is an excellent procedure for picking up cancer. It is an excellent procedure for picking up large polyps. We're not 100% sure yet about smaller and flatter polyps. The limitation is if you find something at the virtual colonoscopy, you can't do anything about it, and then you have to refer somebody for a full colonoscopy to take it out. But there are these kind of trade-offs with all different procedures. And I would say that clearly either a colonoscopy or the possibility of a virtual colonoscopy would be the ones that I would recommend in your circumstance.
A virtual colonoscopy, if I'm correct, is it's sort of a CAT scan or MRI with some kind of material that you've ingested in advance to line the line so that the image is picked up?
Well, basically what you take is you need to take the same materials to get your colon cleaned out that you do for a colonoscopy so that you don't confuse colon contents with anything else. Because you need, in either circumstance, whether we're talking about a sigmoidoscopy, a colonoscopy, a barium enema, or a virtual colonoscopy, you need to get the colon completely cleaned out of any solid or semi-solid material in order to be able to image it.
But is it then just done with an imaging?
Yeah,
and then it's so it's brief too. Is that it, or do you have to?
It is reasonably brief. But it is just an imaging. There's no instrumentation use.
Yeah, this is all moot because I don't think it's approved in my HMO. What about anti-inflammatories covering, problems? I'm taking anti-inflammatories now for pain, and I just wonder. I have some problems, and I'm going to reschedule the sigmoid into a colonoscopy on your advice, and because I've been thinking about it already. But it just bothers me that I'm having symptoms and of a variety of kinds, and it seems like I'd have to be even more careful or something, because this could be masking.
Right. Well, if you're taking anti-inflammatory agents, like many, many other medications, they are excellent medications and have some problems with them, too. And one of the things that the anti-inflammatories can do is they can significantly irritate the stomach and cause either minor or, fortunately, rarely major amounts of bleeding. But the most significant thing, if we eliminate those few cases where it'll cause major bleeding, although you know it's some significant number, but it's still not a tremendous percentage risk. People who are on anti-inflammatories or aspirin, for that matter, can have a minor amount of bleeding in their stool that may not show up, but will be there chemically. So that if you go to the physician and get checked with these little cards that you mail back the specimens for, you ought to be sure to tell your physician if you're on anti-inflammatories, because you want to stop them for several days beforehand so you don't get a false positive. And similarly, vitamin C can have the exact opposite effect, where it can chemically interfere with the reaction that shows that there's blood there, so that you could have blood there and you'll get a false negative if you're on vitamin C. So if you're going to have either of these things checked, you ought to, for the week beforehand, be off of any aspirin or anti-inflammatories and be off of any vitamin C.
Thanks very much. What about, if I might follow up one more on that, the Celebrex and the Vioxx, is it? The more expensive ones? I'm not sure they're in the formulary either, but are those significantly better for that problem?
They cause less irritation, but no irritation. That wasn't good English. I know that they cause less irritation, but still some, and that can cause problems.
All right. Thanks a lot for the time.
My pleasure.
Next, we're going to go to a listener in Chicago on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you. In addition to the family history, there's a cross-cultural background that is interesting, where people from other countries come here, wind up having health problems due to the change in diets. And to the extent that we are what we eat, there's a matter of the change that may precipitate changes in our health. So to the extent that we can digest and assimilate the food properly, I want to ask a question about the matter of enzymes. I've heard so much attributed to the benefits of enzymes in helping digestion. Could you comment on that?
Sure. First of all, humans have an incredibly wide tolerance to most of the things that that any other humans eat, far, far more so than almost any other mammals. There are some exceptions in that some adults, and in the case of African Americans, as many as two-thirds or more of adults will be intolerant to milk because of a lack of the enzyme lactase in their intestine. That they tend to tolerate milk and dairy products very, very well as children, but then in their 20s or at some point not long thereafter, tend to develop the intolerance of it where it causes frequent diarrhea. And that's why a significantly large number of African-American adults, sometimes without even being terribly consciously aware of it, tend to have very, very little dairy intake. That can be particularly a problem for elderly African-American women in dealing with osteoporosis unless they get calcium supplements. And that probably is the most significant routine enzyme-related problem. If people have any difficulty digesting and absorbing food, they will usually, not always, but usually have diarrhea as part of their symptom complex.
One thing of elderly people who may have reduced productive enzymes, you know, that is, they're not producing to the full potency, possibly, whatever reasons, would supplemental enzymes be some consideration they might want to look into?
For most people, that's not a problem. Most of the enzymes that people take are not necessary. In general, if you're maintaining your weight in a normal range and don't have diarrhea as a symptom, probably you don't have an enzyme deficiency.
Well, okay then. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we go to a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. You've answered most of the questions that I had about colonoscopies. I have a history of colon cancer with resection 11 years ago, and have, because of an elevated CEA, I've had very frequent colonoscopies. And because I'm a difficult scope, they are excruciating. So I was very pleased to hear about the virtual system, and I wondered if that would work for me since the other is so painful.
Well, most of the time when people undergo colonoscopies, they're sedated.
Yes, I've been sedated.
Right.
Yeah.
And when people have had part of their colons taken out, that usually makes it easier. But obviously there can be exceptions, and you are one.
Right.
If you are 11 years post-colon resection and have had no evidence of recurrence, that's a very reassuring finding.
Yes.
You still need ongoing surveillance. And I think you need to coordinate with your physician. How often do you need to have a direct look, and how often would a virtual colonoscopy, that now that it's available, suffice for what you need? Part of the problems that can occur is that in the area where your colon was sewn back together,
mm-hmm.
And I don't mean necessarily individually yours, but at any time anybody has their colon operation, has it sewn back together, there can be some inflammation and twists and scarring there. That can be confusing at times on a virtual examination. Things can look like a mass that may not be, but that's probably easily resolved. But I think a conversation with your physician who knows the specifics of what's gone on is in order.
And is the virtual procedure, is that generally available or only in...
It's available in most areas. There may be some rural areas where they don't have the facility, but I would think in most urban areas of any size now that they're having them. They're having them far more frequently. There are
uh-huh.
new facilities becoming available all the time. And that's paralleled the virtual colonoscopy getting better. If we were having this conversation 2 or 3 years ago, I would say that it's not there yet. It needs a couple more generations of software before they can perfect the images. But they've pretty much done that, and while there still remains to be some difficulty in picking up small lesions, by and large, it's a fairly good procedure.
And cost-effective compared to a colonoscopy?
To be honest with you, I don't know what a virtual
uh-huh.
colonoscopy costs,
okay.
So I can't answer that.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Other calls are welcome. The phone lines are open. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our topic this afternoon, men's health. Our guest is Dr. Richard Corlin. He's a gastroenterologist and the president of the American Medical Association. He teaches at the UCLA School of Medicine. As president of the AMA, Dr. Corlin is associated with a new health guide from the AMA, a new book on health, the American Medical Association Complete Guide to Men's Health. And this is the 11th AMA medical guide out now for the lay person. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, listeners, I welcome your telephone calls, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Just to follow up on what we've been talking about, since we've gotten a couple of calls now on the colon and colon health, Is there any reason these days to have a barium enema?
Well, a barium enema, it can be used. I have a prejudice being a gastroenterologist and believing that the colonoscopy gives much better information. But there are circumstances where the entire colon can't be visualized for some technical reasons. A woman who's had a hysterectomy, for instance, who may have a lot of adhesions in her pelvis, it may not be possible to examine the entire colon. And under those circumstances, clearly the barium enema can see that portion of the colon that we can't with the regular colonoscopy. So it remains an important test, though I believe it has been largely replaced to a significant degree by the colonoscopy. And not the least of which reasons is that if we find something, we can either biopsy it or remove it right at the same time.
I want to ask another gastrointestinal question before we go to our next caller here. And I know a good number of folks now who have had that 40th birthday present and the 50th birthday present. And it seems to me that I am hearing a lot of men talk about heartburn and reflux disease. Are these conditions on the increase in men, or is this an age at which this problem is more prevalent?
I think both. We're seeing more of esophageal diseases of all kinds, and we're entering into an age when those are far more prevalent, and we're more aware of those symptoms than we used to be. Heartburn, occasional heartburn, anybody's going to have. And occasional heartburn, if it's infrequent, and all you need to do is take a couple of doses of antacid or drink a couple of glasses of milk and feel better by tomorrow, that's probably not terribly significant. But people who have heartburn on a regular basis, a couple of days a week or more, ought to be concerned about the fact that they could be having a significant amount of reflux disease of acid from their stomach into their esophagus. And acid is normal in the stomach and tolerated very well most of the time. It's not normal in the esophagus. And if acid splashes back up from the stomach into the esophagus, then it can cause a significant amount of irritation. The problems with that are that, number one, first of all, it hurts. Secondly, it can cause ulcers and bleeding in the esophagus. Thirdly, when it heals, it can go on to scarring and narrowing in the esophagus, and people can have difficulty swallowing. And fourthly, it can go on to, as with chronic inflammation or irritation in any area, to cause an increased incidence of cancer of the esophagus. Which is a particularly nasty kind of cancer. And the two symptoms, two questions rather, to ask if people have trouble swallowing is how long have I had it and am I losing weight? And what we really are concerned about, the people who should be checked right away, are those who come into a physician's office with less than 6 months' symptoms or are losing weight. And those are particularly troublesome situations. It's also important to evaluate it carefully now because we have some excellent medications that can really reduce the amount of acid that splashes back into the esophagus and get rid of a lot of these symptoms. But I think, as with many other things, there are things that people can do at home, particularly if you have just occasional heartburn. And we need to go over what are those things that will predispose people to getting acid splashing back up in the esophagus, acid reflux, which is a commonly used term now. And those are being overweight, eating certain foods that will relax the muscles of the lower end of the esophagus, garlic and onions, and even though we don't think of it as a problem, mint at times can be, going to bed on a full stomach, lying flat in bed at night. And that's why most of us will tell our patients, go to bed on an empty stomach. If you're overweight, lose weight. There's a whole variety of reasons to do so, and weight loss, and maybe we can do that in a few minutes, weight loss should always be sensible and not radical. And sleep with your head elevated a bit. Not on a few pillows, because that never works. You just bend your head forward and wind up sliding off of them at night. But perhaps elevate the head legs of the bed 6 or 8 inches so that the whole bed is tipped up a little bit. Those are fairly simple and very inexpensive things that will often provide a tremendous amount of relief. And ignoring the weight loss as a factor that will help can limit how well people can do on almost any other regimen.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm on a cell phone. Do I need to turn off my radio, or can you hear me?
I can hear you, but turning off your radio would be an excellent idea.
Okay. Off. I've been listening with great interest and gratitude until the point where your guest said he didn't know how much a virtual colonoscopy, I don't know if I'm saying that word right, cost. And then my all my dander stuck up, because I think physicians have to know how much these things cost and know the realities of paying for them as part of the care. I'm so glad to hear about preventive weight loss and inexpensive solutions like raising the bed and vitamins and such like. That's really wonderful. But need to know ballpark how much these things cost, and hope that physicians will actually inform themselves. It's so hard to get a huge bill and speak to somebody in the medical profession, and they simply say, well, I'm sorry, I'm paying attention to science and everything else. I can't be bothered to figure out how it is people pay for these services. Thanks so much. I'll hang up and listen.
Yeah, I think your point is very well taken, and perhaps what I should have said is I don't know what they cost in Illinois. I know there are 2 or 3 centers around here, and the charges for them run between $600 and $900. So the charges do vary across the board, and what they are where I am doesn't mean that that's what they cost here. I think the most important thing to check if somebody has one recommended is, number one, what is the cost there, and number two, is it something that's covered by your insurance?
Okay. Let's talk with another caller in Champaign, a caller on line two. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Back to colostomy, colonoscopy. If someone is in their 70s and otherwise healthy and there's none in the family, is there any reason to have one? I've been sort of resisting.
Okay. I think there's every reason to have a colonoscopy if you've never had one before, because we do know that polyps can occur and be asymptomatic for very long periods of time. Being over the age of 65, since the 1st of July, a screening colonoscopy every 10 years is a covered benefit by Medicare, so it makes it economically a lot easier to have it done. And just as we're concerned about a lot of other screening procedures, from the simplest to getting a blood pressure checked up to having cardiograms and mammograms and whatever, I do think that someone in your age bracket who's never had a colonoscopy, that it would be a reasonable procedure to have it done once. If it's completely negative, then you don't have to worry about it for a long period of time again.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine, our guest this afternoon, Dr. Richard Corlin. Doctor, we haven't talked about healthy diet and exercise yet, and
right,
this is something that I think before we wrap up today, we should really spend a little bit of time on. The guidebook, the American Medical Association Complete Guide to Men's Health, spends a fair amount of time on this topic, and it is a topic that we've heard the message. Now, whether we've taken that message to heart or not is another thing. And I'm wondering, if an individual hasn't been diligent or has, let's say, been careless about their diet and exercise over the years, what advice would you have for them in terms of getting started?
Okay. Several bits of advice, and I'm glad you asked that question. The first bit of advice I would have is get started, and let's deal with the diet issue first and then the exercise. Regardless of how long people have been on a diet that's not a perfect diet or even not a good diet, the sooner you get on a good diet, the better. Now, it doesn't mean that we have to eat things that never taste good at all. We want to be rational and do things in moderation. But the kind of a diet that's important is a diet that, number one, keeps us at our ideal weight. And there's so many people that are overweight in this country. That represents a serious, serious health risk, both for heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, diabetes. That's much, much worse in the African-American population than a Caucasian population. But these are things that are under our control to deal with. I think the way we need to approach it is to recognize that any diet at all, is basically a gimmick, and that's fine as long as we recognize it for what it is. The problem is if people go on a diet and lose weight, it implies that when you lose your weight, you go off the diet, the weight comes right back. And I've seen that happen in patients over and over and over again. What I am far more in favor of is the kind of program which recognizes that there's a basic caloric equation of about 3,500 calories equals a pound. For every 3,500 calories you burn up more than you take in, your weight goes down a pound, and the reverse is the case as well. That people should approach not as I need to go on a diet for a period of time, but approach it the way an alcoholic approaches his or her addiction to a substance, the substance abuse, when they want to stay dry. They don't make a commitment for life. They make a one-day-at-a-time commitment. And I believe what's important, and we're talking now about the typical person who may be 20, 30, or 50 pounds overweight. I'm not talking about the morbidly obese patient who weighs 500, 600, or 700 pounds. That's another condition completely, obviously. To recognize that a pound a week is an adequate weight loss. And if it takes a year to get to the weight that we should be at, well, that's pretty good, because that means that if you stick to the program, you're going to be retraining your eating habits, and you're going to be losing a pound a week. It's an achievable goal. You know, these programs, I lost 40 pounds in 10 days, you know, unless you had your leg cut off, that's not a valid claim. And if you retrain your eating habits over a long period of time, chances are you're going to stick with them. Another circumstance that's available now is a variety of very good books that are available in bookstores that have to do with low-carbohydrate diets. They tend to be easier for people to stay on, particularly now that we have sugar substitutes, because you can still eat things that taste pretty good. Low-fat diets tend to be harder for people to stick with. And I'm not going to give the name of any book. I'm not advocating any book. But the key thing is to start on a rational program. Again, if you're in this moderately overweight range, to recognize you need to start on a program now, stick with it every day, accept a pound a week as a successful goal, weigh yourself just once a week, not once a day, and as long as you're achieving that pound a week or more, you're doing the right thing. Now, let's get to exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Any exercise program that anybody in middle age or beyond approaches or decides to go on should be done with at least a medical review to begin with, to be sure that there's not some condition there that would prevent the exercise. We don't have to think about everybody going out and buying a $150 pair of Nikes and training to enter a marathon. But what I think we need to recognize is that for a whole variety of people, particularly more elderly people, once they are checked medically and that it's clear that they can do it, even 20 minutes or 30 minutes a day of brisk walking may be very good exercise for them. And brisk walking can be defined as the most rapid pace that you can comfortably maintain. You get a little puffy, but you don't wind up thoroughly exhausted. And with people who begin this kind of a program, we'll find that over the course of 6 weeks or 8 weeks, by sticking to a program that they do every day, will increase their exercise tolerance, will increase what they do. If it's brisk walking, you'll find that within the same 20 or 30 minutes, you're walking further than you were before, simply because you're in better condition. It will also help depression, in a lot of cases, getting in somewhat better shape. And another factor that's important, and this is not terribly inclusive for all items, but putting the joints through the full range of motion to avoid restricted motion, again, particularly in the elderly. It's not terribly important that the elderly people go through incredibly strenuous exercises, but what is important is that they go through full range of motion exercises every day, at least swinging their both shoulders up and around completely so we don't restrict the shoulder action. It's amazing how much loss of joint motion can occur if we don't do these things. Just common sense, moderate exercise with getting a physician first to check to be sure that there's nothing, no health condition you have that means you shouldn't do it. As long as you're cleared for it, you'll typically feel better, often wind up looking better, and emotionally you'll feel better as well, and it's very good for your health. Blood pressure goes down. Blood sugar tends to go down. Cholesterol tends to go down. It's excellent all the way around once you're checked and approved to do it.
Yeah, and your mood goes up.
Yep.
Thank you so much for talking with us today, Dr. Corlin.
Been my pleasure.
Dr. Richard Corlin has been our guest this afternoon. He's president of the American Medical Association. He's a gastroenterologist. He teaches at the UCLA School of Medicine. And he's associated with a new AMA book on health, the American Medical Association Complete Guide to Men's Health. This book is one in a series of 11 books now from the AMA on health for the layman. The AMA Guide to Men's Health is published by John Wiley and Sons.